In the late 1920s, in the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra, there was a talented and promising violinist, one who had studied with several of the greatest musicians of the era and quickly rose to become second concertmaster. A talented soloist, he established the Cincinnati Chamber Music Society and was recognized as a young man with both masterly technique and great promise. Yet, it was a promise that would ultimately be fulfilled not in the concert hall, but in courtrooms and academic halls, where this violinist, Raoul Berger, would become one of the most distinguished legal scholars of our time. Raoul Berger is now acknowledged as one of the foremost interpreters of the Constitution's role in preserving liberty and in safeguarding the rights of states and individuals.
And I do think that he's inspired a generation of persons, actually on both the right and the left, to return to the original understanding and to steep themselves in those materials.
Berger's view is really a very Lockean view when it comes to the importance of language. Locke, of course, famously in the Essay on Human Understanding, talks about the abuse of words and why words are intended to spawn in the mind of the person who listens or reads those words the same thought that was in the mind of the person who spoke or wrote them. And that's Berger's view of the Constitution, that there is an original meaning that's there. If we work hard at it, we should be able to ascertain what that original meaning is. And as he said of impeachment, ascertaining that original intention tells us what the limits are on the power in question.
Raoul Berger's pursuit of legal scholarship followed an unusual course. Born in Kremnitz, Russia, Raoul Berger's family came to America to escape the era's widespread persecution of Russian Jews.
I was born in 1901 in a little town of about 30,000 people that lay in a valley, overshadowed by what one may call a mountain, which was a great golden cross. Kremnitz was in the midst of a religious circle. One might call them Russian fundamentalists. There were constantly processions by the Greek Catholic Church, the priests dressed in costly vestments and carrying banners that were equally elaborate. We cowered behind the curtains to look out at these processions because we were Jews. And this was a time of so-called pogroms at Zhytomyr. The Jews were a sort of a scapegoat. And there was, as I later learned, there was ample reason to believe that these riots and massacres were inspired by Stolypin, who was a sort of minister of the interior, where persecution was official, not fortuitous. And another thing, my father had served in the army for several years, and he sniffed the coming Russo-Jap War, which is, as I recall, broke out about 1904. And so he slipped out of the country and went to America.
Raoul's family settled in Chicago, where his father, who had been a forester in Russia managing the forest preserves of wealthy nobility, found work as a cigar maker. And like so many immigrants of the day, found that starting a new life in America was a struggle.
Well, to begin with, they'd all been brought to America by tales that the streets were paved with gold. And it may sound naive that they were bitterly disappointed to find out that this wasn't so.
While in Chicago, Raoul's father decided that young Raoul should pursue a practical profession as a civil engineer. However, it was the violin that captivated the young man's heart. Listening to one of the family's few recordings, he was captivated by the beautiful sounds of Misha Elman's violin.
One day, There was an itinerant salesman of German factory fiddles who prevailed on my mother with my vociferous assistance to subscribe to a once-in-a-lifetime offer, namely a German factory fiddle accompanied by a bow and a canvas violin case, and this, it recalls it to my nostrils, the smell of resin, which we used on the bow. And in extenuation, mother had to explain to father that it was now or never.
Soon the young Raoul found himself totally captivated by music, but not necessarily the music one would immediately expect from a future second concertmaster.
It wasn't that I drank deep of the Imperium stream. Quite the contrary, I didn't come down the high road. I came down to what one would have to call popular music of the era. And that meant gypsy music. I still remember with deep affection a composition by one of the great violinists of the time, Pablo Sarasat, Zigeunerweisen, which is German for gypsy airs. Gypsy airs was a string of pathetic melodies interspersed with virtuoso decorations. And for quite a while, I must unashamedly admit, I was enchanted by Spanish music, Hungarian music, and to this day, my toes still tingle when I hear, for example, the Barbered Bride, some of the exuberant and exciting Bohemian dances. I retain an affection for that.
Showing great promise, young Raoul began to earn the attention of some of the most talented teachers of his day, and he learned lessons that would serve him well throughout his life.
One very valuable thing did come about from my study of the violin, because it's like good tennis or good golf. A good stroke is composed of a myriad of things, and study of the violin taught me patience. It wasn't going to be overcome overnight. Patience and rigorous attention to detail. Those are two things I think that I carried over when I went to study law.
Raoul's musical prowess blossomed and eventually led to his becoming concert violinist and soloist with the symphony orchestras of Cleveland and Cincinnati. Yet, in the orchestral setting, his enthusiasm for music began to fade. In Cincinnati, Raoul worked under the direction of Leopold Stokowski, one of the most renowned conductors of the day. Yet, he found his experience confining and less than rewarding.
I think he can be hit off in a phrase that somebody else coined: a genius corrupted by his vanity. No question about the man's genius. He left an imperishable record of that in his records. Beautiful sonority, a wonderful ear for sound, great imagination, fiery drive. But for him, it was always Stokowski and Beethoven. Stokowski and Brahms, which was always me, 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 Stokowski.
As his disillusionment with performing in the orchestral setting grew, Raoul looked for other pursuits.
It wasn't that I became disenchanted with music. I was disenchanted with music in the way I had to perform it to make a living. People have often asked me, Did you leave music because you could earn more money as a lawyer? Hell, it took me years before I earned as much as a lawyer as I was earning as a musician. That wasn't what led me out of music. But here was something that I really worshipped. And the only way I could practice it was having somebody wave a stick over me.
Raul started school at the University of Cincinnati, studying whatever subjects he could.
It was really juggling, because if you were to ask me what was my major was whatever hour I could catch, because the rehearsals and the concerts had first call on my time. And it was only if a class was given at a time when I wasn't playing in the orchestra that I could work. And so, for example, here I was, one course was at about 5 o'clock, Beowulf. What am I to Hecuba? What is Hecuba to me? But Beowulf it was.
As he finished his work at the University of Cincinnati, Raul was still somewhat unsure of his next step in life. He briefly considered a medical career, but abandoned it after a visit to a dissecting room.
What was the alternative? Business to me meant peddling Frigidaires from door to door. So I decided the only alternative is open is law school.
Entering Harvard Law School, Raul had the opportunity to study with a number of distinguished professors, including John Henry Wigmore and Felix Frankfurter. In fact, Raul Berger maintained virtually a lifelong correspondence with Frankfurter, who helped found the American Civil Liberties Union and later was appointed to the Supreme Court by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1939.
I had a fellowship, and I came to call on Frankfurter, introduced myself. And I should confess it. All my life I was and remain a romantic. So I come to Frankfurter, and I said, Professor Frankfurter, I've come to you here because from what I read in the papers, the administration is just lousy with problems, that maybe you could use some help. I'm not here for a degree or for anything. I just want to get into a project where I can do something useful. So he looked at me in blank astonishment, he said. And he almost embraced me. He said, my God, he said, here's a fellow that just wants to help. He said, fine. He says, I'll dig up something for you before much time passes.
Yet perhaps the most influential legal scholar in Raul Berger's educational career was Leon Green, the dean of Northwestern University School of Law, a prominent scholar and stimulating teacher.
He hammered away incessantly the formulae the judges were framing were simply means of reserving control of the process from the jury, so that the judges ultimately called the shots rather than turning over judgment to the jury. But above all, he refused to stop with the words. The formula was just a rationalization. He tried to inquire what was really at play here. And that stuck with me.
Leon Green would later prove instrumental in helping Raul Berger to obtain a position where his legal knowledge could be put to work. This was a period when the number of positions available for Jewish attorneys in most prestigious law firms was limited by the attitudes of the times.
I went job hunting in New York. A friend of Frankfurter's was a senior partner in Root Clark at Ballantyne. That was one of the great Wall Street firms founded by Elihu Root. And Frankfurter says, you go and tell that I sent you to him, Emery Buckner. They started out together as cubs working for Henry Stimson, who was then in the cabinet. Well, Buckner was a grand fellow. And he said, if it were up to me, Mr. Berger, I'd staff the whole law firm with Jews. But he said, I've got partners who know that there's a great deal of prejudice in dealing with them among their clients, and I couldn't get anywhere with them here. He had people like Henry Friendly, who became a judge, brilliant fellow. But instead of just wringing his hands, he said, here, now wait, let me make a few telephone calls. On the theory that you never know where you're going to strike fire. And he called up some of the leading, half a dozen of the leading law firms and partners. But of course, where he couldn't get past his own partners, they couldn't get past theirs. But he made a try, and I honor him for that.
One of the things that's easy to do when you look at someone who's had such professional success as Raoul Berger is to think that it was always easy for him, and in fact it was very, very hard. As he ceased being a violinist, moved on to law school, on to get his Master of Laws degree at Harvard, he then found that because he was Jewish, he was not going to be employed, that he faced ostracism at all the major law firms. He even was not able to get a teaching position at Northwestern Law School because he was a Jew. And this was with the intervention of the dean and a very close friend of his, letters of support from people like Brandeis and Frankfurter, and it simply wasn't enough. So he faced some real dilemmas as a young, struggling lawyer, which is largely why he went into government service. There was no prohibition there, and he found himself able to flourish as a lawyer.
Ultimately, it was Leon Green who came to the aid of the frustrated young job seeker and who helped Raoul secure a position with the Securities and Exchange Commission.
I wasn't going to get into a private law firm. I saw that, so I went to work for... I went to work for the government, and I went to the SEC because there again... Leon Green was a great friend of Jerome Frank. And Jerome Frank was chairman of the SEC.
Soon, the promising young lawyer was lured away from the Securities and Exchange Commission to the Department of Justice. However, making this step was not an easy decision, and he called upon Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis for advice and counsel.
I explained that I had no trial practice and had the notion that it would be very useful to learn something about how to try a case. He unhesitatingly urged me to do it and said that he found trying cases was one of the most useful factors of his life because, he said, I found that if I could frame an issue in terms that the average man could understand, I could rely on his good sense to come to the right conclusion. And he said that gave me an abiding faith in the democracy.
Raoul Berger found that his work at the Department of Justice soon put his own faith in democracy to the test, as he encountered a case that was very important to the development of his legal philosophy. Catlett versus the United States was a 1942 case that involved the harassment of a group of Jehovah's Witnesses who were proselytizing in Richwood, near Charleston, West Virginia. A group of local American Legion members forced the group to drink castor oil and paraded them through town to the post office, but the Jehovah's Witnesses refused to salute the flag. Deputy Sheriff Martin Catlett and Police Chief Bert Stewart took the side of the Legionnaires and detained the Jehovah's Witnesses. The newly created Civil Rights Section of the U.S. Department of Justice brought suit against the Chief of Police and Deputy Sheriff for failing to provide equal protection. The Attorney General at the time was Francis Biddle, who was told by the local district attorney that with the community's wartime sentiment, there was no chance of getting a West Virginia jury to indict the defendants, let alone convict them.
This was a dead cat. Nobody wanted to come near it and touch it. And I was a little man on a totem pole, and they put the B on me. Will you take it? Well, I figured, everybody figures you can't win this case. And if a miracle happens and I win it, well, I'll be heroic. So I took the case and went down. It was a lesson. Of course, to them, I was a foreigner. Not merely that I came from outside the terrain, but I was a Jew to boot. The defense pulled at every heartstring they had. We'd indicted the chief of police, too, for failing to offer equal protection. And they had this, the mother of the chief of police, her quavering old voice, and a whole procession of ex-state bar presidents. There wasn't a string that they didn't pull. Well, I just stuck to one thing. This was at a time when we were having people who enlisted and went to Plattsburgh and drilled with broomsticks. And I played one string. I said, look, we're fighting Mussolini for doing exactly the thing that these fellows pulled off here in West Virginia. If it's intolerable in Europe, it's even more so in West Virginia. Well, to my astonishment, bearing out what Brandeis told me, that if you could make an issue intelligible to a jury, you could count on their good judgment, their good sense. And he said that gave him an abiding faith in democracy. And this proved it to me. This bunch of horny-handed mechanics and farmers and whatnot, they saw the bigger issue, and they rose above their prejudices and voted these guys guilty. Well, they appealed to the Court of Appeals, the Fourth Circuit. This was closer to my area of expertise. I could write an appellate brief. And I persuaded the Fourth Circuit to go along with me that this was a denial of equal protection. And by God, you know, now that I think of it, I think that's the first equal protection case.
I think that he could get a conviction in that case with a local jury against a despised minority. And what's important is that the Justice Department had the courage to go in and to prosecute state officials. And that's precisely what the Justice Department did in the mid-1960s when they went into Mississippi and prosecuted Sheriffs Price and Rainey, who were responsible for murdering civil rights workers. And no local jury, unfortunately, in that time and place, would convict.
Throughout the 1950s, Raoul Berger continued his work as a government lawyer, then entered private practice for a time. Yet, later that same decade, he felt the need for a change in his life.
It was a go-around. My wife had passed away in 58 and left me pretty disorganized. And I went to Vienna with the object of becoming a boulevardier. There's no opprobrium to being a loafer in Vienna, whereas being a loafer in Chicago or New York is déclassé. So, it didn't take me more than 2 or 3 weeks as a tourist to get some idea of the riches of Vienna. And I had my fill of sightseeing. And I'd taken my fiddle with me. And I should say, by this time, I was the owner of a very beautiful Stradivarius. And so instead of practicing an hour a day, as I used to do when I was practicing law, I'd practice an hour before I practice on the violin before I'd go to my office. I began to practice 2 and 3 hours. And by gum, I began to say to myself, there's life in the old boy.
Raoul decided to once again try his hand as a concert violinist. And he rented a small concert hall at the Vienna Philharmony, the same evening as a concert by the noted conductor von Karajan in the main hall.
So I hired the hall, and lo and behold, it was a sellout for the von Karajan concert, and the people did just as I expected. They had nowhere else to go, so they came to my concert. Now, all the critics but one did not come to my concert, but the one critic did noted that I play a very beautiful Stradivarius, to which I add a footnote that Yasha Heifetz was indignant when somebody referred to his violin. He says, just remember, it doesn't say a thing till Heifetz plays on it. And then noted that I was now a lawyer. And for a lawyer, I was a truly extraordinary violinist. So that was the last go around. From there, I never touched a fiddle again. Now, you had this critic, I can now say truly, had this critic not kissed me off as a fine violinist for a lawyer, I might have stayed on in Europe and played 3 or 4 times a year just for the fun of playing.
After his sojourn to Vienna, Raoul Berger embarked on a career devoted to academic pursuits. His interest became increasingly drawn to the Constitution, and he began to develop his views regarding the importance of original intent as the most appropriate framework for interpretation of the Constitution.
I was increasingly disturbed by the vast amount of discretion judges enjoyed in overturning administrative regulations, even statutes. And I began to ask myself, where do they get this grant of power? And it took quite a while, as a matter of fact, for the clouds to thin out. I found the best expression of my own views, oddly enough, in Marbury against Madison by Chief Justice Marshall, who boiled it down in a series of sentences that really deserve to be engraved in every introduction to Constitution, to the Constitution. And he said that the framers were extremely jealous of the power that they delegated. And to make sure that it would not be distorted or usurped, they reduced it to writing in the form of a constitution, which was expected to be binding.
Berger's view of the Constitution's role as viewed in the context of the original intent of the framers distinguished his thinking from the mainstream thought of his time. Many liberal thinkers felt that an understanding of original intent was either impossible to attain or not relevant to the issues of the day.
Berger took a different view. First of all, he thought that you could do originalism. That is, he thought you could look at primary sources and you could draw out of them some sense of what the framers thought on a particular point or on a general issue. And he also demonstrated that that kind of analysis was useful in interpreting and applying the Constitution. But I think more important was the promise of originalism for Berger. He understood the importance of the rule of law. He knew that its enforcement depended upon faithfulness to the original understanding of the Constitution. And the bottom line was, he valued the survival of the rule of law more than he valued the adoption of particular public policies, no matter how strongly he favored those policies.
I think one of the most interesting things that one sees in Berger's body of scholarship is the constant relationship that's brought into question between the Constitution and the legal antecedents that led up to it, especially the English common law tradition. Berger is famous in all his works for going back to English legal history, to the reports of the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, to find out what a particular phrase meant, to find out how it developed, to find out how the founders might have understood it. And I think what you see in the relationship relationship with the Constitution was, of course, best expressed by James Madison when he said, the Constitution cannot be presumed to incorporate the entire body of the English common law. That would have included the entire ecclesiastical hierarchy, he said. But what you can do is to look at provisions in the Constitution that were specifically adopted, such as high crimes and misdemeanors, and you can find those as a signpost leading you back to the English legal history, back to the development of those ideas, back to that tradition with which the founders themselves would have been intimately familiar and from which they chose the phrases and terms of art that they thought would suit their constitutional interests. So I don't think there's any conflict between that notion of trying to determine original intention on the part of the founders, as Berger has in Impeachment and other works, but simply realizing that you have to be guided by what the founders thought they were adopting and the evidence that they've left as to what the words meant for them.
In the early 1970s, Rowe's thoughts on the Constitution resulted in two landmark books published by the Harvard University Press, Impeachment in 1973 and Executive Privilege, published in 1974. Both turned out to be incredibly timely as the Watergate issues beset the Nixon administration. And as a result, Berger became something of a celebrity, appearing on Bill Moyer's Journal, being interviewed by William F. Buckley Jr., and being featured in numerous articles.
Rawls' first real explosion of fame came during the Watergate controversy. He had been at work for years on pursuing the questions as to what was the nature and extent of impeachment under the Constitution, what was the notion of executive privilege. And then in the space of 24 months or so, Richard Nixon brought it all to a head. These questions became not simply abstract academic queries, but frontline headline news in the New York Times and the Washington Post and all the major papers. The question about the impeachment of a president, the question of Nixon's claims of executive privilege, and Rawl was simply there at the center of it.
Rowe Berger's work regarding impeachment still serves as a seminal source for understanding the intent and use of impeachment according to the Constitution's framers.
When we think of impeachment, we think of two great cases, one of them Andrew Johnson, the other Clinton. But there was an earlier one and very, very significant, the impeachment of Justice Samuel Chase, which exhibits partiality in its most naked form. Claude Bowers, who was an estimable historian, wrote that prior to the trial of Samuel Chase, the Federalists met in caucus and decided that they would unitedly vote for acquittal. This is the obverse of the hanging judge. Sworn to impartiality, they had, before they heard any evidence, they made up their mind, they're going to vote as a block to acquit Chase. Now, that, to my way of thinking, certainly is an extreme example of partisanship as you could ask for.
Berger's work on impeachment, his subtitle tells it all. It's Impeachment, the Constitutional Problems. Berger set out to find out exactly what the founders had in mind when they crafted the terms of impeachment in the Constitution. He wanted to find out what the history was, what it meant, how it had played out through American history. But his real focus was how a power that was given for what the founders would have seen as grave national emergencies, especially dealing with the presidency, was used basically to get rid of judges who were guilty of small-time corruption. And that's what triggered his interest, and that's what he began to pursue. He got into impeachment and found that it was much less clear-cut historically than perhaps people would have assumed. Of course, part of the reason was impeachment had rarely been used at the grand scale at which it would be invoked in the Nixon case and, of course, most recently in the Clinton case. But he looked at it from the perspective of how did we get to where we are from where we began. And as is always the case with Berger, he begins with the query, what did the founders intend, and to pursue that to the, as full a degree as he possibly could.
When you come to look at the Clinton impeachment, it shouldn't be surprising that the Republicans rallied around a Republican agenda, and the Democrats did likewise. That's the nature of the beast. Now, the next question is, What were the meets and bounds? Now, one of the things that fascinated me was the words high crimes and misdemeanors. How high did a crime have to get to be to register as a misdemeanor? Treason isn't like murder directed against a private individual. Treason is intended to subvert the state. So is bribery to a lesser extent. You bribe somebody so that the course of justice will be influenced in his favor. And that led me to feel that we've got to look for high crimes and misdemeanors in areas which subvert the state to a higher or lesser degree. If bribery subverts justice, impedes justice, how can we say that perjury or any act of monitoring or obstruction of justice is less a high crime and misdemeanor? The inclusion of bribery after treason, in my judgment, compels me to conclude that any obstruction of justice is a high crime and misdemeanor. So I would have had no difficulty on the proofs, and I wouldn't go behind the genesis of what caused a man to obstruct justice. He did it. And it's the act that's punishable.
One of the great virtues of Berger's work on impeachment, and I think the book's lasting quality that will certainly make it required reading for everybody who tries to understand impeachment, is his survey of where the provisions of the Constitution came from. The Constitution, of course, provides for impeachment on the basis of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Treason and bribery are rather forthright and straightforward, but high crimes and misdemeanors seem to be somewhat confusing. Gerald Ford had famously said that high crimes and misdemeanors means whatever Congress wants it to mean. Raoul Berger's response to that is, no, it does not. And his chapters on the meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors, I think, will remain a foundational point of departure for anybody who wants to know what the Constitution really means. What it really meant, in Berger's view, was very serious public acts on the part, especially of the president, that would undermine public security, public safety, public confidence, that were serious breaches of public duty and public responsibility, did not depend on being an indictable crime. It could be a political offense. And what Berger showed, starting with the late 14th century, was that high crimes and misdemeanors had always been present in impeachments from early English law on through. It was a theme to which impeachment proceedings in England had constantly returned. And it was a phrase with which the founders were intimately involved because the impeachment of Warren Hastings was going on as the Philadelphia Convention was sitting. So when they used high crimes and misdemeanors, this was not simply empty words chosen out of the blue, but really what could be called terms of art, legal terms of art that everyone knew what they meant. They had recourse to the great legal treatises such as Blackstone and Hale and Cook. They understood that the English tradition had a set meaning, and that set meaning they more or less adopted for the Constitution of the United States.
In addition to his work on impeachment, Raoul Berger's thoughts on executive privilege became a cornerstone for legal scholars.
One must look at our system of government as a sort of a partnership, three partners: executive, legislative, judicial. And here's one of the partners who says, I'm sorry I can't tell you about this because it's not conducive to our mutual advantage, but trust me, I'm doing the right thing for all three of us. You would find damn few partnerships that would embrace that. If you're a partner, you're entitled to know. You don't have to take it on trust. And then two, if you look at the history of the creation of the executive branch, it emerges really with crystal clarity that they did not intend to clothe the president with the power to hide any of the secrets of government from the other branches. So there's no historical basis for the claim. And yet, executive privilege is tossed around as if it were a sacrosanct doctrine. And when I say constitutional myth, what I mean to say is it has no foundation in fact.
And executive privilege is one of those ambiguous notions of constitutional law in the United States. It really makes its first appearance in the 1950s, dealing with the McCarthy hearings and things like that, the Eisenhower administration refusing to give over information to congressional inquiries. And the claims were that presidents had this special privilege of communication, that they could refuse to turn over their documents or their records of personal conversations or meetings to Congress for scrutiny. Berger began to explore this, and again, he's very straightforward. His book, Executive Privilege, its subtitle gives away his view. He entitles it simply A Constitutional Myth. From Berger's point of view, there was no executive privilege. There's nothing in the Constitution to suggest it. There was nothing in the history of the founders to indicate that they had thought about it. And therefore, it was a contrivance on the part of presidents to serve their own interests. What was interesting about Berger's work, of course, was that in 1974, the Supreme Court answered the question as to whether there was executive privilege in the case of U.S. against Nixon, when they said, in fact, there was something called executive privilege that was implicit in the doctrine of separated powers. And therefore, while it was not an absolute privilege, it would fall certainly to the judges to decide when to use it, when to allow it, rather, in a criminal inquiry, as was the case in Watergate. And Berger's argument that it was a myth was rather curtailed, was undermined, as it were, by the Supreme Court's own decision in 74.
Raoul Berger's work established a standard of scholarship and, at the same time, launched a number of critics of his positions. Government by judiciary, in particular, struck a resounding chord with critics.
Government by judiciary reads like a brief against the Warren Court's usurpations. But in many respects, it also reads like an indictment of the court for its dereliction of duty. It's a little bit like Thomas Jefferson's excoriation of George III for his many usurpations and derelictions. It laid bare the legal and philosophical poverty of the Warren Court jurisprudence. And it sounded a clarion call for a repudiation of that philosophy. It was such a powerful indictment of the Warren Court that the very title of the book, Government by Judiciary, became a shorthand expression for all of the jurisprudence of the Warren Court. It was simply Government by Judiciary. And Berger, like his mentor Felix Frankfurter, simply had no patience for the courts making public policy in the guise of construing the Constitution.
One of the things that operates against adoption of my view is that it requires a change in fundamental thinking. And men don't like to change their opinions. The opinions come slowly, they're hard won, and now along comes a maverick and says, everything that everybody believes is wrong. Believe me, it's wrong. So there was resistance to change on the one hand. It would call for a reversal of so many cases that they hold dear, starting off with Brown against the Board of Education. That's become the holy of holies, the whole test of where you stand. And there again, I concur the result, if I were to consult my own tastes, I would go along with my opponents. But that's not the test. And that's something I've said for a good 30 years.
In addition to its critics, Government by Judiciary also won many admirers. In fact, it became one of the sources of ideas during the Reagan administration, prompting the president to write a note to let Raoul know how important his work had been to the administration.
If I can dismiss my predilections. Why should I attach greater importance to those of Ronald Reagan? As a matter of fact, what I would have done when I was a youth was to say, if Donald Reagan's for it, it can't be so. But I swallowed Donald Reagan because it seemed to me he stood on firm ground. As a matter of fact, my wife put her finger on it. She said to me, the mark of wisdom in your view is that he agrees with you. And that's true.
Another area of constitutional law that Raul has studied extensively is the interpretation of the Commerce Clause.
When I examined the history of the Commerce Clause, I found that almost all of the references to it were in the frame of a single proposition. Namely, it was designed to prevent one state which had, let us say, a harbor or access to commerce, to prevent that state from taxing the other states for the privilege of access. And I found nobody that attempted to qualify that, and that Madison, among others, felt that that was the narrow purpose of the Commerce Clause.
Raul Berger gave considerable thought to the doctrine of incorporation and how it might be best interpreted in terms of original intent.
Incorporation is a theory that one or more of the clauses of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, the clause that the court relies on most frequently is due process, the clause which is the more plausible is the Privileges and Immunities Clause. The argument is that one or more of those clauses incorporates, by reference, all of the provisions of the Bill of Rights, which were originally intended only to apply to the national government, and applies them to the states as well. And that tends to destroy the federal system, which was intended to be a source of great vitality, great experimentation. It was assumed that states might do one thing and other states might do another. Now they are straitjacketed by the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Bill of Rights because of this doctrine of incorporation. It's devastating in its impact on federalism.
Raul Berger's thinking on the doctrine of incorporation was clear-cut.
The Bill of Rights applied to the federal government only. That was made clear by Marshall early in the game. And they've taken that and superimposed that on the states, so that states are now governed by a Bill of Rights which had no application to them at all. And I can say on the basis of firsthand reading of every syllable of the 14th Amendment history that there was not the slightest reference to making a Bill of Rights applicable to the states. In the 14th Amendment, the states were not bent on abdicating their powers. At best, it was meant to extend to the blacks privileges for which had theretofore been withheld from them.
Berger says that the concept of incorporation is nonsense, that there's not one shred of evidence in the original understanding that sustains that view of the 14th Amendment. What makes that controversial is so many public policies that are now favored by substantial portions of the American public and the ruling elites would fall if the incorporation doctrine were overturned. I think his understanding of the 14th Amendment and the doctrine of incorporation is enormously significant. The idea that the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, or any other clause of that amendment, incorporates the Bill of Rights and makes them applicable to the states is historically fraudulent and intellectually indefensible. And yet, the modern court has invoked incorporation as the justification for fastening upon all of the states a whole set of public policies, including a common code of criminal procedure. In essence, it has been for many decades conducting an assault on the retained sovereignty of the states. And in the process, it stripped them of their traditional police powers and significantly reduced the role that they were expected to play in a federal republic. So I think that his scholarship, which has made what the court has done so clear, is enormously significant, because if you eliminate the doctrine of incorporation, then the court's ability to enforce this common code on the states is greatly limited.
Through all of his work on constitutional law, Rauberger sees what he considers a disturbing tendency of ongoing interpretation.
The existing system where the courts make law offers a field to the academicians that's altogether too tempting, because all of these theories that the courts apply initially are formulated by lawyers, and they win the assent of judges. And I just can't see judges, academicians, surrendering an area in which they've had so much fun. If I recollect rightly, Stanley Cutler of Wisconsin opines that if a law is needed and Congress doesn't make it, the vacuum can be filled by the courts. Well, God, that's a monumental misconception. The power to make law resides in the legislature. It isn't transferred to the courts because it isn't exercised by the legislature.
Over the years, from government practice to legal scholarship, Rauberger has held a steadfast commitment to understanding the Constitution and how it should apply to our legal processes. It is a studied analysis and has yielded one overarching principle that has guided his thought.
Berger's scholarship was so well researched and so well written that scholars could not ignore it. And so liberal scholars were driven back to the original sources. Scholars who shared Berger's instincts were inspired to dig even deeper into original materials. And so the consequence has been an enormous flowering of research into the original understanding. Now, scholars have taken different views of what those original materials tell us, that is different from what Berger assures us they tell us. But originalism is now a legitimate exercise. Beyond that, originalism is now legitimate in public discourse and in legal argument. I think the most telling tribute to the influence of Rauberger's work is that if you read opinions of the Supreme Court of the United States today, you see justices on both sides of whatever the issue is referring to original documents. So that the argument increasingly in the Supreme Court with respect to whether one side should prevail or the other is, what is the original understanding of this provision?
I think if you look at Berger within the broader context of American constitutional history, and if you consider that constitutional history to be defined in a way to this day by the broad position staked out by Thomas Jefferson on the one hand of strict construction and Alexander Hamilton on the other for loose construction, that Berger probably tends more toward the Jeffersonian than toward the Hamiltonian. I think he looks at the Constitution, he determines that this is a document that was written and ratified. It had a meaning. It had a meaning to those who wrote it, it had a meaning to those who ratified it, and it had a meaning to those people who agreed to live under it. And therefore, the constitutional historian's obligation is to find out what powers were given, what powers were withheld, and how those powers were to be administered. And Berger's inclination is toward the Jeffersonian view that if it's not there, you can't put it there.
The Constitution represents one of the very rare times in our whole history when the people were asked, how do you want to be governed? And they voted for the Constitution, which, by the way, was bitterly fought. There were many that were opposed to it. In reading the Constitution, you must put your own personal predilections aside. I have genuinely tried, oftentimes, when the result ran counter to my own sentiments and deepest emotions, I have tried to be faithful to the words as understood by those who use them. The key to reading the Constitution is not that it favors the position that I entertain, but that by all the rules of interpretation, of logic, it can mean nothing else. In coming to judgment on any issue, I've always tried to view it as dispassionately as possible. Scanning the words, scouring the history, and even if the result put me in bed with Ronald Reagan, I stuck with it. I would say cling to the Constitution. It enabled us to survive at a time of over 200 years when one empire after another toppled. And not a little of that survivability turned on the fact that it was a government of limited powers that were more or less scrupulously observed.
Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, I thank you for your patience and forbearance, and count this. I didn't know that life still held another experience for me, but it did.
I think there are plenty yet to come, Ralph.
I better duck before they do.